Hi, my name is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring a talk from our 2019 U Sports Fall Summit, available in full at fortheloveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, and sports leaders develop programs to ensure kids love their game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. Let's all work together to make sure the kids love what they play. Thank you. Today we're doing a multi-speaker interview and tried it last go around and it worked really well. So really excited to have the opportunity to talk to three amazing people doing great work in the space and contribute to an article we'll do a deep dive on in this interview. Not necessarily any particular order. Veronica Allen is postdoctoral fellow at York University School of Kinesiology and Health Science. Independent content contributor and coordinator for Canada's Sport Information Resource and has a PhD in sports psychology. Cassidy Preston, a founder and lead sport of performance psychology consultant at Consistent Elite Performance, is a founder of Complete Hockey Training, also a PhD in sports psychology. And Jessica Fraser-Thomas, associate professor at York University School of Kinesiology, Health Sciences. Contributor to numerous research articles and books focusing on positive youth development and has a PhD in kinesiology. As you can probably tell, I'm a little humbled that I'm having a chat with three people with PhDs. So I'm looking forward to the chat. So let's from the deep dive perspective. So I'm just going to show it and you probably can't, it might be blurry, but this is the full page article that caught my eye and the reason for the reach out to all three of you. And the title of the article, Kids Lose If Winning Is All. And I thought it was brilliantly written, brilliant contributions. Started with Veronica. Right at the top, there was the quote, "Ironically, the competition-oriented structure and win-all-cost culture limits opportunities for players to develop not only hockey-specific skills, but also personal assets such as making friends and building character." Maybe let's start with that and let's see where we go with the article. Veronica, what's the takeaways from that?
Yeah, so I think in general, the article is about not just how the current kind of structure and culture of minor hockey might be limiting hockey-specific skills, the development of hockey-specific skills, but also kind of those broader developmental outcomes that we can think of that we associate with sport. So things like it says, like making friends or building social skills, leadership, other types of life skills that we might think is transferable from sport. So I think in terms of those hockey-specific skills and physical development, the main takeaway is just that when we focus so much on games and winning, we're actually limiting opportunities to develop individual players' skills. So a lot of this came from Cassidy's research, so I'm sure he'll speak to it a bit more, but essentially finding that when in these, especially with really young players, there's so much focus on needing to win individual games in order to make it to the playoffs and then win the playoffs, for example, we're tending to prioritize the top players. So the people who are getting ice time are often the people who might be more developmentally ahead, for example, not necessarily those who are working the hardest or improving the most. And so we're giving mainly opportunities for development to just top players and not all the players on the team. And then the other thing is just that the games, at least from Cassidy's research, showed that coaches were often focusing on short-term strategies for winning games during those practices instead of strategies for teaching individual skills. So they were also being limited in terms of just the skills they were developing in practice because they were so often focusing on things like team systems, even in like 8-year-olds, which wasn't necessarily the best thing for that age group. And then that also extends to kind of those broader developmental outcomes that I was discussing. So if we're constantly giving playing time to only the top players, we're not really allowing for other opportunities for development or transferable life skills in those other players that might not be getting those opportunities to play or practice as much. So a lot of what we found in Cassidy's research was that there were these performance-related kind of expectations that coaches would have, and they would allocate playing time based on whether or not players were meeting them. So in hindsight, the coaches might think, well, the athletes that are working the hardest and kind of developing work ethic and those types of skills are going to be rewarded with playing time. But in reality, it was just the players who were the most experienced or skilled. So it didn't necessarily translate into those improvement or kind of work ethic-related values. So essentially just showing that when we have this sort of competition focused structure and this win at all costs kind of culture, we're really just limiting a lot of those opportunities for development, not just physically, but also in other ways as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Ironically, I've just done back-to-back Dev 1 clinics, and that's the competitive age group, Peewee and above, in the rep stream. It's not quite as bad in Western Canada yet, but I suspect the trickle effect. I know in Ontario that winning all costs has really become a driver. But, you know, when I've been doing these clinics for 11 years, when I first started preaching subjects like, you know, develop all of your players collectively as a team, you'll get better, develop their life skills, focus on fun. I had these coaches in these clinics just go up one side of me and down the other side of me. But ironically, the shift I've seen is they are buying into the long-term player development. They understand the importance of keeping kids in the game. They see the costs. And it's like we have two different routes now. You can either go academy, high level, high performance, you know, a lot of money. And then there's the renegade leagues that are kind of popping up versus, you know, grassroots, minor hockey. Let's focus on keeping kids in the game. So shifting hats to Cassidy, and what was intriguing is you followed these coaches on, I think it was four different teams, as well as you've coached. What was the insight from that?
Yeah, so like, especially like looking at directly the coaches, the big insight there, again, goes straight back to the sport structure, which is, first and foremost, the coaches were generally like, they're good coaches. Like they mean well, they say the right things. They're trying to do the right things in terms of develop all the players, and try to reward them sometimes for work ethic and those kind of things and make it a fair and development focused environment. But at the end of the day, the sports structure is just so push winning. And like you got two practices in a week and two games. Well, what are you going to do in those practices? You don't get evaluated on how good your practices are and how much they're developing. You get evaluated on how you win. Like the coaches in the GTA area, you only have a job and can continue to coach if your team wins. Like it's rarely does a coach that loses all the time sticks around for very long. And so then what are they going to do in those two practices? They're teaching power play units or, you know, systems and things that aren't really age appropriate development. And how are they reacting to winning and losing? And, you know, if you're coaching 13 year olds, that can be a really hard age to like interact with and goofing around and trying to create the structure, and coaches can get on edge about that. And so it gets the best of them. And like, and I've coached that level and I'm doing it with all this awareness of the research and best ways to coach. And it wasn't easy for me. And like, it's hard. And I want to like coach to win. And so like, trying to find that balance is really hard. And so kind of one of the ways I frame it is like, I don't necessarily inherently blame coaches for the way they act. The coaches are just in a way a product of their environment. And like, you know, you put these coaches in a different environment, they will coach very differently. And an environment that's much more focused and a structure that reinforces development instead of winning and losing and all outcome focused. And I'm not necessarily suggesting that we need to not keep scores ever and things. It's more just to what extent and how much it's prioritized and the way the whole thing's structured and laid out. But yeah, that would be certainly one of the main kind of takeaway that I like to highlight from the coach's stand. And so in a way they're kind of counteracting each other, and which is the way I like to highlight it. Winning and long-term development, they kind of go hand in hand, which is what you're saying. Like in the way when I coached and a lot of these coaches, they believe if we focus on long-term development, long-term we'll be the better team and be more likely to win. And the teams I've coached have had success with that. And these guys and the coaches, they had some success with it. But then as an example, I've seen obviously lots of other coaches where it's just like short-term winning. It's like, and the way that they do it, which is really crazy in the GTHL, is it's all about recruitment. It's like it's literally the professional sports model where players get recruited in November for next September. So right now it's already November. It's happening. There's conversations with players happening and cut and making teams for next September at ages 10, 11, and definitely older. And so, but like that's how those coaches survive. It's not a development program. It's a recruitment program. And it's like, and so which is a sink or swim model. And so if you know, swim great, but not sink, see you later, and you're out. And then that also, you know, the other thing that really, you know, grinds my gears in a way is like the AA, AAA kind of like all of these players, you know, because they're older, more mature, starting at 9, 10, they get the elite coaching. and all the double A guys are getting, you know, the volunteer parent coaches and less, and then the single A, like, they get nothing. And it's like, we're not developing everybody. And then you'll eventually see it. All of a sudden, these double A players jump up and make the triple A teams because they're late bloomers and they grow late and they stick with it. But like, why weren't they getting, you know, age appropriate and, you know, helpful, accurate coaching for their skills and appropriate skill development throughout their whole career so far? And so the system in that way, definitely, again, that's, again, sink or swim from the coaches, from the structure, from the double A, triple A. From the recruitment standpoint, like that's all very, very flawed. And people boast about how good the GTHL is and it's the best development league. It's not a development league. It's a recruitment league that just has a lot of players. And so, yeah, the top ones are good, but it's not developing top players. Like a good example that, like a lot of guys will leave their from other cities to come to the GTHL to play. I'm thinking that's going to give them more advantages. And there's some players, like there was players last year, the guys come from the Sault Ste. Marie, and then they don't even get drafted. And they were touted players, and they kind of got, you know, ate up in like this machine of the GTHL, where there's a good example. The highest goalie drafted last year was Ben Goudreau from North Bay, Ontario, my hometown. And he went 7th overall, highest goalie drafted in a long time, chose not to come to the GTHL, easily could have went to any team. And didn't, and he's having success, and it plays into his mindset and the family values and those kind of things. But a good example, but most of the G, and there's this, that's crazy. I've got a lot to say about it, but the last thing I'll say that kind of grinds my gears a bit related to like this whole city and this outcome is like, even their slogan is "We play in the G" or "I play in the G." And it's like, it just breeds like arrogance. Oh, because we're better because I'm in the G. Like, what is, like, what are we teaching kids? Like, and it's like, oh, I'm better than you because I play in this league. Like, you're just playing minor hockey. Like, what are we, like, this is not the end, but it's that kind of mentality that they're breeding. And so it's highly, I'll go on forever. So I'll stop there. But
yeah. Let's just say I feel your pain. I feel it immensely because I've seen it happen in British Columbia. We've got a renegade league that's popped out that is not sanctioned by Hockey Canada, is not sanctioned by BC Hockey, and they are recruiting 6, 7, 8-year-old kids starting in September for spring hockey. And they're giving them extra ice and da-da-da, and then all these parents are going, oh, we got to sign them up for that because they want to be on the elite spring teams. And Wayne Goldsmith, who's a high-performance sport consultant in Australia, he's got a great analogy, did a great talk. There is no such thing as an elite 6, 7, or 8-year-old kid. Please, it's not part of my vocabulary. Please remove it from yours. And what his job was is he went around Australia looking for Olympians, like Olympian potential talent, 17, 18 years old when Brisbane was hosting the Summer Games. I thought, That's brilliant. I believe that there's no such thing as elite until Olympics. That's when you're elite. But you're using elite for 6-year-olds? That's a misnomer. But that's a conversation we could have for probably hours and hours on end. I'm going to switch the curve now to Jessica. The young age groups, is this becoming a problem? And when are you seeing how early this really becomes an issue with that elite status and parents chasing that?
So thanks for the question. And very early. So we've just spent a season immersed in various preschool programs. And there's a lot of variety out there. There's for-profit, there's not-for-profit, there's club, there's private. So there's a lot of different things going on in preschooler sport. It's sort of a bit of the Wild West in terms of, we all decided we needed it before we understood what was good or bad about it, and we're still trying to figure that out now. But certainly in the context that we did explore, hockey was the one that did come out with a very professionalized model from a very young age. So we were seeing 5-year-olds that were being selected to, you know, the higher level team and playing games once or twice a week and working towards making, you know, an end goal of being the best in the league. And that was at 5-year-olds. So certainly we're seeing it very young. I think to a lot of points that Cassidy has raised, you know, they're it's almost impossible for coaches to work in a system that's designed that way to implement their philosophies, their approaches, And I think you spoke, Glenn, to this idea that there is a camp that is embracing this long-term development approach that is understanding that, but there continues to be the camp of the academies and the elite eight-year-olds and driving that path. And I think the bottom line is we can't have two paths. So it's not going to be successful, because really two paths is just determining that there is an elite path at age 6 and 7. And we are pushing potential talent, future talent, out of the broader pool at a very young age if we start with two paths at age 5, age 6. And really what I think, you know, this whole lens of what should sport offer and in terms of positive youth development and all of these outcomes that we claim or assume that sport may be offering, you know, it goes back to having the opportunity to play, to live that culture. And so there are many things that, again, aren't automatic, that aren't deliberate, but I think those transferable skills are, there's a great potential for them through the structure of sport. And what that is, you know, sport offers the win or lose. There's one or two outcomes, but also and we don't have that as much. There's a lot of do your best and that's good enough. And so I think the win or lose does teach important life lessons from a very young age and does teach how to navigate through challenge, through failure, through those sorts of things. But if you're not engaged in that process, then you're not learning those lessons. There is opportunity to develop leadership skills, but you need to be part of the team, you need to be playing, you need to be engaged with the team in order for that to happen. There is an opportunity to develop interpersonal skills and teamwork. Again, you need to be playing as part of the team. You can't be the bench warmer all the time in order to, yes, there are lessons to learn on the bench too, but if you're always on the bench, if you're sort of, to the examples Cassidy provided, eaten up by the system, then no, you're not going to learn those lessons that sport can potentially offer. So I think going back to this idea of we need one talent pool that is given opportunities to develop through childhood, through early adolescence, as opposed to pushing people out of that stream at age 5, age 6, at very young ages. I think that sort of speaks to many of the things that Veronica and Cassidy and yourself have already highlighted on that deep dive.
So in the blurb I sent out, anticipates the questions, have any of you seen the Tim Hortons commercial where they start off with 67% of parents think that youth sports are too serious? Have any of you seen it? And Sid and Nate are sitting in these little chairs with these teenage age players, 5-year-olds. What's your take on that, if you've seen it?
Sid McKinnon.
So does anyone else want to go first?
Yeah.
Or?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. I just watched it this morning. I really liked the commercial, actually. And the first thing I thought was, well, like, I'm currently a runner, but if you gave me a pinata and 10,000 puppies, I'd certainly take up hockey. Like, sounds great. But it actually was funny because I'd been reading, and one of your kind of questions that you'd given us was kind of what are some things we could do to help keep kids wanting to come back and like sport more at the end of the season as opposed to the beginning. And the first thing I thought was, well, we really need to ask kids what they want and make sure that it's about them. And then it was like basically the commercial was that. So that was kind of my takeaway was, well, it really aligns with how I think that, especially for the younger kids, we need to make sure it's about what they want, that they're having fun, that they're actually developing that kind of intrinsic motivation and interest to want to continue in the sport before we start kind of like hammering away on the physical skills and the drills and things like that. So that was kind of my takeaway. I thought it was a really great commercial, but I actually don't know where the stat came from at the beginning.
Yeah, I don't know where it came from. I'm trying to find out where they, because it'd be great to find that research to actually quote it with background, right? I mean, they just come up with it, because there's the other statistic that's been thrown around for years that we've been sharing. 70% of kids are pulling out of youth sports by the age of 13. So it's the other conundrum. And part of it is the seriousness, the pay to play, all the stuff we're talking about. But that's been well documented in many nations, not just in Canada, but US and what have you.
I always struggle with the 70% because that's a stat from a paper in the 70s or 80s. And I mean, it's really, really hard. We do not do a good job of tracking participation as a nation, because leaving one sport doesn't necessarily mean leaving sport completely. And there is, you know, many benefits to sampling, to switching, to diversifying. So we really do struggle as a nation to measure who's doing what and what the actual pathways or journeys are. But certainly there is more recent work that suggests that, you know, first of all, that less than 50%, around 50% are involved, and that, you know, and then the other struggle is trying to know what the pathways are. Have they stayed involved in one sport, and is that a healthy path, or have they diversified in a number of sports and specialized in one sport, or have they, you know, really played recreationally in a variety of sports? And again, that may measure as dropout, and we need to be cautious in measuring that as a negative outcome if they're trying different things. But anyway, sorry, sidetracked there, but I always get my back up a little bit, because that 70% is one of those numbers that was one of the first numbers we had access to, and we've continued to quote it for years and years, that we don't really know if there's actually any solid roots to it.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried to do a deep dive in terms of registration numbers, and it was actually in the article, Hockey Canada's registration numbers kind of plateaued a few years ago around almost 640,000. Now it's around 625. But one of the reasons why hockey has grown in Canada is not because the boys that continue to go up the pipeline, is the huge exponential growth of the girls coming into the pipeline last 10 years, and now represents about 18% of the membership. So if you back the girls out, which is about 85,000 girls, you're coming down to like 500, you know, well below. So there has been drop at the boys level. I'll ask Caskey this question directly. The OHL does their initial dub major junior draft a year later than we do in British Columbia. So they're 15 years old. We're drafting at 14 years old. So that would be your minor midget, because I'm trying to think of the Ontario model.
We're minor midget draft here.
Is that where you start to see like extreme insanity? Because I'm telling you, in our bantam A1, my son was in that pipeline, and it was there was craziness. Like, you had executives that were firing coaches because they were letting the kid go from the A1 team. Ours is A1 instead of AAA, and then down. Yeah. Like, give me some insight on that.
Yeah, for sure. It definitely kind of peaks and leads up to it. But I would say sometimes at that age, the parents are like, they've been worn away to a degree. I did a talk, I think last year, with the AAA team to the parents, and it turned into less of a talk and more of a venting session for the parents, because they've been so stressed by the GTHL for so long. And so sometimes it comes to a head, but sometimes parents are just like, they're almost checked out by that point to a degree. And it's just like, whatever happens, happens. And cause I often see, it's like often even the craziest early on when parents aren't used to it, and they're all like, you know, full of, you know, vinegar and vigor, and they just want to go out there and help the kids so bad and see them succeed. And they're so excited about the game, the sport, and it can actually be even really problematic at the young ages. And one of the funny lines I was going to say earlier, talk about elite youth and recruiting. I mostly work with older athletes, but one of the younger ones, I think he's like 10, had came in, and I go like, "Are you worried about what other people think?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I'm like, "Who?" And he goes, "Scouts." And I was like, "You're 10 years old, and he's worried about scouts." I was like, "What's like the OHL draft already?" And it was actually like more coaches and selection for the year after, and the brick tournament, and trying to make the brick team, and all those kind of things. So. It definitely kind of plays a role throughout, and definitely the draft though is a hard one, and definitely, like, especially on the kids, I find it really hard. Like, I work with a lot of kids in their draft year, and it's like they're really worried about that and the expectations they have and expectations other people put on them, and that can really weigh on them.
So we got 5 minutes. Last key takeaways, Veronica. You've been quiet for a bit, so I'll let you kind of lead this one. What can we do to bring the game back to the kids?
Yeah, I guess I was just thinking, actually building off a little bit of what Jess and Caskey have been talking about, kind of some of the, I have a couple of kind of ideas just around like simple things. So for example, just coaches can ask, like I was saying earlier, ask kids what they want, and that can look very different. So it could even be like, if you have pre-planned drills or specific things that you're trying to implement in practice, try to include athletes in those decision-making processes. So ask them, like, what do they think about the drill? How can it be changed? What would they do to improve it? Things like that, just to keep them involved and get their input and kind of just like doing what they want to do a little bit more, giving them more autonomy over the work that they're doing in practice. And I also think, kind of speaking more to that, like societal kind of shift in attitudes, if whenever there's opportunities just for more kind of affordable and community-based options. So I'm specifically thinking about, and I don't know how realistic this is in hockey, because admittedly this isn't my sport or area of expertise, but there's a basketball league in Kingston called the Pete Peterson Basketball League. It costs $10 to play, and it's totally volunteer run, and it's just one game a week, and they have all kind of volunteer coaches across different divisions. And the reason this basketball league has existed and it's been around for 65 years is because as the players come up and graduate from the program, so many of them come back to coach and volunteer and help out with registration that it's able to be just totally sustainable, really inexpensive model. And the schools donate the basketball court time, things like that. And there's been some research done in this area, and it's such a great program, and it's got so many great outcomes. And they've even had kind of, you know, across the board, they have athletes that go on to play in the NCAA, playing with kids that never pursue a basketball career. But the whole point is that they go and have fun and play a game together. And the more skilled athletes will help the less skilled athletes. So it's kind of just like a supplement to kind of existing programs. It's not necessarily the program that's going to create the best athlete, but it's just having more of these affordable options to get kids involved. And I think giving them an option where they can just go and have fun, especially if they're already involved in these highly invested programs. So those are just a couple of ideas that kind of I would build on with the other stuff.
That's great recommendations. Actually, one of the best players I ever coached, he ended up playing major junior. One of his favorite things he did, and he did it regularly, was stick and puck. He would just go down to the rink, play stick and puck for an hour. Well, not even play, just be out on the ice, getting away from the structure. Cassidy, anything else?
Magic? Yeah, I'll give you my my kind of pipe dream vision. Which would be like if we could, which I don't even know if, could blow the whole thing up and the whole structure. How would we create it from scratch? And my recommendation would go something along the lines of, so each area or organization would be responsible for creating a development program. And so how big that is, it's, I guess it depends on the everything. But it would be like, this is now we're going to create an optimal development structure for this sport. And it would look something along the lines of like, there would be a technical director. So it's like somebody who's really well trained and is going to oversee the program and the development for that area. And that's like their full-time job. And then they bring in kind of like sub coaches that help do all the development and run, you know, the small area games and practices and the skill thing. So there's lots of touches and it's a development system. And then at a certain point they start to have games or, you know, a league, you know, maybe when they get older, and then those are just like volunteer coaches where they're rolling the lines and maybe giving some feedback, or again, the sub coaches, but there's a structure there of like a hierarchy of coaches. Whereas right now what we do is the opposite of that, is like, there's a board and they select coaches and they each coach one age group and are responsible for one group of players. And then it goes down to double A. So it's just like, so I would just scrap all of that and do it a very different way. And the players could still be categorized based on talent so that there's competitive practices and small area games and things. But it would be a little more fluid. And even as they get to like 13, 14, when there is like, you know, an elite team to a degree, there can be fluidity between the double A, triple A. Like, I think that's, kind of that concept will be important. And then obviously within that too is there's like free play time where it's just like shinny skates and like that's put into there too. And so the whole thing's like put in place, and then with all the people in a certain area, the cost of registration would be drastically down too, right? Which is obviously going to be a big factor. We might cut out there. Sorry if I cut out there.
A little bit of buffering across the way.
Which is going to drop the cost to play, and then there could be like, you know, subsidies could be even put in place, and that's kind of like, that's, I think, you know, I talk a lot about Sweden's hockey's model and Iceland soccer developmental model. Like, they don't cut kids, so they're like 18 for Iceland soccer, and they punch way above their belts in the soccer world. Like, it's because they have a development program. And if we could blow it up and there was a structure place and that, like, the thing that, cause I work with, like, I've worked with tons of minor hockey organizations, and it gets really problematic where I'm like, okay, maybe we can change things so we get more practice time in this. And be like, nope, we want to just keep doing it the way we've always done it. And I'm like, so I was just like, it's like, I'm just banging my head against the wall here. And so I was like, you can't even do it in one team to get hard to get people to change anything. So it's like, you know, how are we going to do it on a structural level? Of Ontario or all of Canada. But that would be, there's a system that I think would be, it changes everything. It changes coaches, it changes the players, the more engagement and fun. And then it's going to change parents as well, where it's just like, the whole thing's prioritized. And it's funny seeing parents fight back about this new thing. I finally saw for the first time this year, went to a novice AAA game, but it wasn't a game. It was two cross ice games going on, or half ice games, and they weren't keeping score. And there's no standings now. And then they go into full ice games, I think, or something in January. But that's only a novice, and it's only games, and it's still not necessarily the whole system. But I was like, wow, that's cool. Like, finally. Like, but like, it's, that's still, like, it could go bigger and more. And but that's got a lot of, like, people up in arms. And so, you know.
And just on touching on that, because you're in the center of the universe in Ontario, GTHL. And I'm not just saying that.
So.
I heard through the grapevine that when they introduced the initiation cross ice with 5 and 6 year old kids, there was a bunch of 6 year old kids who were playing full ice games with their 7 year old elite counterparts in the Renegade League, and they pushed back. So Hockey Canada could not roll out novice cross ice at the same time as initiation. They did in phases. BC has been cross ice for 4 years.
Yeah.
Like, we've decided we're going that route because USA Hockey went that route. You touched on Sweden. Sweden melts their ice on April 1st. Kids can't play spring hockey. This is a great model. And there's so many other examples. But in respect of time, Jessica, have you got anything else to add?
I just feeding off of all of your points in the last round here. But I just I think this idea of blowing up the system to begin with is I really we've done a lot of band-aids and a lot of, you know, but I really think it's something that needs to happen from the ground up, and Veronica's example was also spoke to that. But I think another piece that could be layered onto this that we see in other nations is just more of an intergenerational approach, more of a community approach. And so, you know, again, separating this idea that the kids are on the ice and the parents are in the stands with their Tim Hortons complaining about the coaches. We just need to take that model away, and we need to put everybody in and make it intergenerational. We need to get the adults active. We need to give them multiple roles as opposed to just forking out their money, and really creating family unity and family and community bonding through sport as opposed to sort of pushing it further on the outside. So I think, you know, just again, feeding on the models that Cassidy and Veronica spoke to is just this idea of, you know, a lot of what we've talked about today is this tension between coaches, parents, structure, and the athletes. And we just need to bring all of those together and make them more cohesive. So there's not a tension between them. They're all part of the same unit.
Yeah, they're all a team. I mean, and coming back full circle to making it community sports instead of all these travel teams and like the separation that we're seeing today. So I can't thank you all enough. This was fantastic. Again, it's a conversation. I can go on forever. As you can tell, I'm really passionate about kids and sports, and I can tell that all of you are, and I admire the work that you're grading. In fact, I had this conversation with 3 PhDs. I'm kind of really humbled. So thank you so much. And the contribution to the article, I'm glad. Hopefully you've got some other people have reached out to you, because we do need to change it. We've got to change the model. We've got to do it sooner than later, because if we keep going down this path, more and more kids are going to pull out, more and more kids are not going to benefit. And I think the last thing, we didn't get do the dive, but the mental illness that's coming because of the stresses, that's also becoming a big issue that we got to address. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Glenn, for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook for Love of the Game, Twitter, TLOTG Conference, and forloveofthegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.